Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everybody. And we will begin today with an invitation for you to help us explain Hong Kong. Call in if you have ties to that city in crisis and tell us what you see as the reason things are boiling over right now and what you see as the stakes. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Maybe you were hearing some of the coverage on the BBC or the Takeaway in the past hour. Now we're going to invite you to call in and help us explain Hong Kong if you have any ties to that city in crisis. 212-433-9692. And we're going to bring on a journalist guest from the French news agency AFP in just a minute. To bring you up to speed, the latest reports say that operations at Hong Kong's international airport appear to be returning to normal now after riot police used batons and pepper spray to break up days of protests there that had brought flights to a standstill. According to news reports from the region, only a few dozen pro-democracy demonstrators remain in the airport, and a court order is restricting protests to two designated areas in the departure hall. By way of some additional background, the protests in Hong Kong are now in their 10th week, which began as a rebuke of an extradition bill, but now have grown to be more about pro-democracy demands in general. The demonstrations have mostly been peaceful, but last week, and maybe this is what galvanized you to pay attention to the story, or maybe you've been following it all along, last week, after police started tear gassing protesters in the street and injured one female protester badly by shooting her in the eye, the demonstrators became galvanized and it took a violent turn. At least a few of them took a violent turn. Here's a clip from a Singaporean news service, Channel News Asia, from Monday from the airport.
This is by far the biggest turnout in a peaceful sit-in at the airport. This after one of the female protesters had allegedly ruptured her right eye after being shot with a beanbag round during violent clashes at Tsim Sha Tsui overnight. These protesters' slogans here is today, police return an eye for an eye, they say.
And in the evening, with tensions rising, some protesters beat two men from mainland China, one of whom they suspected of being a security officer, while the other proved to be a reporter for a Chinese Communist Party-owned newspaper. At a press conference this week, the Chinese government escalated their language using the word terrorism to describe the protests. Here's a clip translated by China's state-owned news service.
Over the past few days, radical demonstrators in Hong Kong have repeatedly attacked the police with extremely dangerous tools, constituting serious violent crimes, and beginning to show signs of terrorism.
So what is Beijing signaling with that escalation of language? Is the withdrawal from the airport a sign of retreat or the eye of the storm? Analysts are describing the protests as the biggest demonstration since 1989. Yes, Tiananmen Square and the massacre that occurred there by the Chinese government. And the Chinese government is now blaming the U.S. With me now is Elaine Yu, Hong Kong correspondent for the French news agency AFP. Hi, Elaine, and welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And just to start at the airport, it seems like the situation is changing rapidly. Can you bring us up to speed further?
Yes, so today we're seeing protesters, a small group of protesters compared to the disruptive sit-ins before, but they're apologizing for the inconvenience, what they call inconvenience, and the disruption that they have brought to travelers. Because yesterday there was a mass blockade, and it was the culmination of peaceful sit-ins at first for a few days. But on Tuesday, our tensions and emotions were running really high. And like you said, police brutality is very much a focus of anger with the woman who whose eye was allegedly ruptured by a beanbag round. So the slogan or the the phrase "an eye for an eye" is graffitied and scrawled all over the airport. And yesterday we saw remarkable and ugly scenes of a group of very angry protesters surrounding men that they believe are undercover cops. And a very important context for that is police have been disguising themselves as protesters, wearing their signature black t-shirts and, you know, the gas masks with the pink filters that protesters have been wearing. And they have been making arrests while disguising themselves as protesters. So that has sent paranoia soaring among protesters, which led to the mob justice we saw last night.
Did you say protest leaders issued a public apology for something?
They have, anonymous groups of protesters have come up with emails and a placard circulated online saying they are sorry for the inconvenience. And people physically there as well at the airport has, you know, been holding up banners saying sorry for the inconvenience. We are fighting for the future of our home. And yeah, there are other online signs that say we apologize for our behavior, but we are just too scared. Please help us. So you sort of see the plea that has come after events that really can be seen as a turning point. And yesterday was remarkable scenes broke out at, you know, the airport, which is usually has such fortified security. And we saw violence on both sides. And today we're seeing something that looks like a self-correcting mechanism, because there are no protest leaders for this movement. So what we're seeing is a grassroots response deliberating, did we really make a mistake last night? And should we apologize for it? And how are we going to do it? So we're witnessing that transformation right now.
How rare do you think that is in politics anywhere for a group that's involved in something like this to issue an apology?
I think it's for the Hong Kong movement, it is quite remarkable, because people have been comparing the movement and authorities, and the movement has been trying to get the government to apologize, to be accountable, and to have some sort of sign that they're reflecting internally. And for the movement, a very important motto that has defined these protests is that they want to avoid the bitter divisions that they used to have in the last few years. And they're saying, no matter what, we don't want to sever ties, we don't want to point fingers, and we don't want to assign blame. So people have been trying not to yell at each other, blame each other for tactics that they think are totally going to backfire or are not helpful. But now I think we're seeing, you know, they have been protesting out of anger and out of passion. And now we see people really looking at what they're doing and saying, wait, we're wrong. We have to admit this and we have to do something about it. So it is rare so far. We haven't really seen that in the last 10 weeks. And this is, yeah, the first time we're seeing this kind of expression.
So listeners, help us. And Elaine Yu, Hong Kong correspondent for the French news agency AFP, explain Hong Kong. Call in if you have ties to that city in crisis and tell us what you see as the reason things are boiling over right now and what you see as the stakes for democracy, for world affairs, even for the United States. 212-433-9692. And Georgiana in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in. Hello.
Oh, hi, Brian. I'm a great supporter of your program.
Thank you.
I'd like to throw a little nuance to this extradition bill.
Mm-hmm.
I have so many things to share, but let me first start with the extradition bill. First of all, the extradition law was actually a law that the basic law drafters deliberately left out. The basic law is, as I don't know if you know, is the law negotiated between the UK and the Beijing government for Hong Kong after the turnover. So
right, and it's good for people to know by way of background, if they don't, that Hong Kong was under British rule for a long, long time, and it was only in the 90s that China got Hong Kong back, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
Right. But there's a term, and Georgiana, maybe you can explain this term to people who aren't familiar with it. There's a term I hear applied to Hong Kong and the mainland, which is one country, two systems. Is that something you know?
Yes, one country, two system basically means, of course, Hong Kong has been returned to China under China's sovereignty. But basically, under the basic law, the one country, the basic law actually is what augments the one country, two systems, you know, one country, two systems. That means Hong Kong, under the basic law, has its own autonomy. Basically, it retains its capitalist system, and it also has its independent judiciary power. It also, broadly speaking, enjoys more freedom of human rights.
Yes.
Like, for example, Falun Gong can practice in Hong Kong but not in China.
Mm-hmm.
And there's freedom of press. These things are guaranteed under the basic law.
So you wanted to say something about the extradition bill that would have allowed accused criminals to be extradited to the mainland, which has a less independent or open justice system, right? What did you want to add about that?
Yes, what I want to add is this extradition bill was not even accepted by the original basic law drafters. They deliberately left it out after a lot of deliberation in the very first place for the very reason that there's no rule of law or guaranteed human rights in China. So why would the chief executive, Carrie Lam, bring it back? That is a big question. And I also want to add that this is the very same reason, the very reason that the basic law drafters did not want it in the basic law, for the very same reason that no free world countries would sign such an agreement with China except France for whatever apparent political reasons that France has, because France does not have common law. And so it's already rejected. So for Carrie Lam to try to bring it back is just puzzling.
Georgiana, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate your insight. So Elaine Yu, Hong Kong correspondent for AFP. In June, the protest began as a reaction to this extradition bill, but that bill is dead. So why are the protests continuing and intensifying?
So there are two parts to this. First of all, after protests, the leader, Carrie Lam, appointed by Beijing, she first suspended the bill, and later, with the protests continuing and escalating, she used the word, "the bill has died a natural death." But what protesters have been demanding is that they want a permanent withdrawal of the bill. And what we're seeing is so much distrust between the government and Hong Kong people that even a dead bill isn't dead enough. They want it. They want the word withdrawn to be used. And people are speculating that it is a political pride on the part of Carrie Lam that she just would not use the word that protesters have been using. So that is the bill specific issue. But you know, throughout the 10 weeks, it has morphed into a movement for democracy. And another very important element is accountability for police behavior, especially excessive use of force. And these protests, it's the first time they have used weapons like rubber bullets and beanbag rounds and very indiscriminate use of tear gas as well, where people think they're not about dispersing anymore. They're kind of used as a weapon to attack people. So we're seeing a very wide-ranging protest movement with the lack of democracy at its core, as well as anti-authoritarianism as its core sentiment as well.
Let's take another phone call. Here's Greg calling from Shenzhen, China. Greg, you're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hey, Brian, how are you doing? We're 12 hours ahead here, so it's 10 o'clock at night.
Well, thank you for, I guess I can't say staying up late at 10 o'clock at night, but thank you for chiming in.
Well, thank you. So I'm here leading an art workshop with high school students in Shenzhen, and some of the students are from Hong Kong, and some of the students are from around China. And we were actually in Hong Kong yesterday for about 5 hours visiting art galleries and art museums. And we went from Shenzhen across the border on the bay, and we drove from gallery to gallery in vans. And we saw nothing of any signs of disruption other than signs on the street picketing for the extradition bill. But the students are following it on social media like WeChat, which is basically, you know, like every social media we have in the United States folded into one app on their phone. And they're seeing all kinds of different streams of information and misinformation, from photoshopped photos of the airport on fire to protesters and all of the things that are happening there. And I have a flight that leaves on Sunday from Hong Kong, and I'm going there the day after tomorrow this workshop ends. And I was, you know, up at 4 o'clock this morning with friends calling and texting me with the information and waking me up and just out of concern. So it's a really chaotic time here.
Are you there with American high school students?
No, they are all Chinese and Hong Kong Chinese students.
Do you have freedom to lead an open discussion among the students?
Absolutely. I mean, I have 9 students, and I'm working with them individually on art projects that engage social and environmental issues. And we're actually up right now putting the finishing touches to our exhibition that gets installed tomorrow. But I mean, Brian, it's even crazy that I'm calling you right now because I'm on a VPN on a wireless network, mm-hmm. and I've gotten kicked off VPNs, and you can't access WNYC. So I'm really sad because I usually listen to you every day, but I'm not able to access it because it's just really difficult to get on the internet. The Wi-Fi is really horrendous here, about half a megabyte down. 0 megabytes up sometimes in this hotel. So it's very difficult to be in touch with the rest of the world. And this is what happens when you're in a closed society. You know, there's not an exchange of information. So I feel like I'm in a micro-utopia in that respect. But every sidewalk I walk down, there's CCTVs, and there's like at least 5 or 6 cameras on every sidewalk. And I've been told by the students that even when you cross the sidewalk, when it's no walk, that they take photos and post them on the internet and shame you for doing so.
Greg, thank you so much. Safe home, and check in with us when you're back, okay?
Thanks so much, Brian. Great to talk to you.
And Elaine Yu, Hong Kong correspondent for AFP. What were you thinking as you listened to that call?
It is such a... It exemplifies the difference between mainland and Hong Kong right now. They're separated just by a border, and he's in Shenzhen, but you see the disinformation campaign at work, and you see how the different information ecosystems that mainland people are in and Hong Kong people are in. So people on the mainland use WeChat, and the tone about the protests, because they're getting censored information, they have a very different view of it. Whereas the conversations that Hong Kongers are having are now on Telegram and other encrypted channels, as well as on a popular online forum where people can protect their identities and, you know, discuss protest tactics. So you really see, you know, the Great Firewall very pronounced, and it's absolutely one country and two internets.
And the Chinese government has been known to use tracking technology like facial recognition software to control certain populations like the Muslim Uyghurs in the western region of China. Are protesters nervous that they will be tracked or are being tracked with technologies like that and punished in the future?
Protesters are extremely nervous about surveillance and tracking. So that's why everyone are wearing masks, and sometimes they even cover their eyes. And instead of using electronic payment for public transportation, they're now going old school, buying single-use tickets. And we're even seeing volunteers and members of the public donating these tickets for young teenagers and kids and young adults who are participating in protests but may not have the funds to buy all these tickets. So they're really taking steps to minimize their digital footprint, and they're showing a lot of tech savvy and surveillance savvy as well.
Let's take another phone call. Here's Ming in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ming.
Hi, Big Ben. Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I'm actually from mainland, but I have been U.S. for like almost a decade. So I guess first, as I said, I put most of the thought on the Hong Kong local government. I think the local government basically turned this relatively simple thing into this mess, this gigantic mess. And I think right now it's a disaster. And I believe the root of this is because the lack of democratic system in basically in the mainland China. And I think the central government basically imposed, they have not allowed the Hong Kong people in Hong Kong to democratically freely elect a leader. And I think there's tremendous distrust between the two parties and between the two parties. And
Ming, what do you think China is afraid of by allowing that continuation, really, of something that already exists, self-determination in Hong Kong?
Think about that. You have like more than 1.3 billion people in mainland doesn't have all the freedom, I guess, and those freedom democratic system can guarantee. And if you allow people in Hong Kong practice those rights, what about those people in mainland think about this? You know what I mean? Because that just basically put a bad example there for the regime in mainland. I think that's what they think. Because in Chinese, we always say like even a gigantic dam can collapse with a simple leakage. So if you have consider if you actually allow people in Hong Kong to enjoy all the freedom basically guaranteed by the law. But
yeah,
a lot of people from mainland actually go to Hong Kong for shopping or for tours.
So they're afraid it would be contagious, basically.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so that's why they control the all the media, all the social media, and all the press. It's getting worse, actually, recently, for the past decade.
Ming, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it. So, Elaine Yu, by way of a little bit of background, why did China allow the one country, two systems system in the first place? They must have been afraid from the start in 1997 that democracy in Hong Kong would be contagious on the mainland.
Yes, and that is exactly what the democracy movement in the beginning has been thinking. They think that if Hong Kong can be democratic one day, it can pave the way for China to follow that system of political liberalization as well. And decades ago, and it continues to be this way, Hong Kong has played a very important role in terms of opening up China's economy in trade, as well as finance and the flow of money. So China actually needed Hong Kong for its economic development. And also Hong Kong's rule of law, which is enshrined in its mini constitution, it has been vital to Hong Kong's role in the region as a hub commercially and for many other things. So Hong Kong has been very valuable economically based on its robust rule of law and the fact that it has open borders, although that is much more so for capital than, say, for for people as well, but there are definitely many critiques of, you know, what that capitalist system actually serves. But long story short, Hong Kong did play and continues to play a very important role by preserving its judicial independence and also its separate system.
The official party line from the state, what's being broadcast on state-run television in China, is that the U.S. is partly responsible for the protests, that it's an American-led conspiracy. Here's a government spokesperson from Beijing, translated to English by the Korean news channel, Arirang News.
We would like to make a clear warning to the very small group of unscrupulous and violent criminals and the dirty forces behind them. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
Now, he didn't say the Americans by name in that clip, but that's what he's referring to by the dirty forces behind them, right?
Yes. Yeah, so Beijing and Chinese authorities have always said foreign forces are behind Hong Kong's opposition. And the implication is that they don't believe people in their country would be so angry that they would stage such a massive, large-scale opposition to them. So it has all, we've seen that rhetoric play out for a long time. And these days, you know, even anyone who looks foreign, there are a few white people, they would quickly, you know, people would, there would be rumors going around saying they are undercover or like CIA. And one wonders how much do they really believe it is other countries behind this? Or is it just a more convenient rhetoric to minimize the power of that movement?
Well, the New York Times reports that it's not just the Americans, a looming vague antagonist, but that the Chinese government is blaming a specific person, Julie Ide, if I'm saying her name right, an American woman working as a diplomat in the U.S. consulate in Hong Kong. What do you know about her?
We know that whenever U.S. consular staff or foreign diplomats, when they meet, it's in their job to meet different a cross-section from society, and government officials from the U.S., especially consular staff, have met with different kinds of activists as well as many other people. So even though that can be framed easily by pro-Beijing media as some sort of collusion or cooperation, or there's something sinister in it, it's actually very common. We've seen that happening many times before, more as a usual, normal thing to do.
Marie in the Bronx has a question. Marie, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. My question for your guest was the following. The story sounds, in a way, very tragic because the protesters seem to be playing in the hands of the Chinese authority and they're asking for help. Who would you think would help Hong Kong in case China cracks down because of civil unrest? What country would do a thing to help Hong Kong? Thank you.
Thank you. And what an important question. Is there an answer, Elaine?
Judging from the international response to China, I think countries are, first of all, China has been accusing other countries of interfering when all they have is an opinion about the Hong Kong situation. And secondly, we haven't really seen the international community stand up to what China is doing, whether it's in Xinjiang with their internment camps there, or whether it's Tibet or Hong Kong. So there might be politicians and even governments who would issue response highlighting their concerns and their worries about the situation. I think judging by China's increasing clout and power, and as well as the West and other countries' unwillingness or inability to stand up to it because of China's increasing power, I think that is very unlikely.
So to wrap up, what is the U.S. role in this today, and how different do you think the U.S. role would be if, say, Barack Obama or George W. Bush were still president?
I think the U.S., because of its position in the world and as well as the current U.S.-China relationship being so fraught, they have to be very cautious, and any move that they make can really invite Beijing's ire. And I tend to think there are actually a lot of conversation that the U.S. Progressives and Hong Kong progressives could be having, and that they're actually navigating very similar issues with police violence and unchecked capitalism and what it means to live with a resurgent authoritarian, you know, Chinese government. So politically, diplomatically for the U.S., it's hard for them to make a move. And one has to question, should they even do anything given its legacy and its imperial legacy in the world? But at the same time, I do think in terms of civil society, in terms of politicians and activists and, you know, public intellectuals, there are a lot of conversations to be had. And at the same time, I think Republicans have been, you know, much more outspoken on this, on Hong Kong and on China issues, than Democrats have been. And I think China would also respond to governmental pressure, and U.S. politicians have to think very carefully about, you know, how they can do this ethically.
Elaine Yu, Hong Kong correspondent for the French news agency AFP, Agence France-Presse. Thanks so much for helping us explain Hong Kong.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
And listeners, thanks to you who called in for helping us explain as well. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So much more to come.